I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today about school lunches. A doctor's group is giving many schools a failing grade. But first, 5 American soldiers were killed, 3 others wounded, in a suicide bomb blast in central Baghdad today, the worst attack on U.S. forces in Baghdad in months. Earlier today, a female suicide bomber killed 4 Iraqis in Diyala province north of Baghdad, including the head of the so-called Awakening Council. These are groups made up of Sunnis who've turned against al-Qaeda. Of foreign fighters. This spike in violence comes as Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz writes in his new book that the cost of the war in Iraq is now at $12 billion a month. Joining us with more, Paul Tate, senior correspondent for Reuters in Baghdad. Paul, tell us first of all about this latest bombing that killed the American soldiers. What do we know?
What we know so far is that a U.S. foot patrol in the Mansour district of central Baghdad was hit by a blast. We don't know for sure yet the cause of the blast. The military only described it as an explosion, but Iraqi police have said it was a suicide attack. A bomber wearing a vest packed with explosives walked up to the patrol and detonated the device, killing 4 American soldiers at the scene. A 5th died later of his wounds. An Iraqi interpreter was also wounded, as well as up to 9 Iraqis at the scene, according to police and hospital.
According to the Brookings Institution, violence is down in Iraq. There were about 700 civilian deaths in Iraq last month, compared to 2,700 in February 2007. But with today's news and bombings over the last week, is there a sense that the tide is starting to turn again?
It's interesting. It's hard to know what to read into this at the moment. Violence is certainly down significantly on a year ago, yet the number of civilian casualties in February spiked sharply by about 36% on the number in January. It was after a series of bombings blamed by the U.S. military on al-Qaeda, most significant among them 2 bombings by female bombers in 2 popular pet markets in Baghdad. Attacks are down across Iraq by between 60% and 70% on since last June, when the so-called surge of 30,000 extra U.S. troops became fully deployed. U.S. commanders have frequently cited improved security as a good reason for them to begin their troop drawdowns, but the last couple of months, I'm sure, have come a bit of a worrying sign for them.
Well, and of course, presidential candidates here in the U.S. are debating withdrawal from Iraq as well. Is there any sense that these actions in Iraq might be in response to, you know, debate that's going on here?
I'm not sure. Interestingly enough, we've been looking at Iraqi reaction to the American election campaign, and I think attacks will continue regardless of whether there's an election campaign in the States or not. Certainly, they may hasten attacks, but I don't think you could say that the attacks are directly linked to the U.S. election campaign.
Tell us a little bit about the earlier attack today. This was the suicide bombing in Diyala province. How important was this shake to this effort to enroll Sunnis in the fight against al-Qaeda?
The Awakening Councils are very important. They came along at about the same time as the surge of U.S. troops was beginning. They happened coincidentally. They weren't part of the same strategy. But since then, the Awakening Councils have been very closely embraced by the military as a way to improve security. This case today was quite surprising. Al-Qaeda have been using female bombers quite a lot lately because they see that it's easier to get through tightened security. This woman apparently went to Sheikh Al-Qaeda's compound yesterday to make an appointment to see him and was told that he was too busy to come back tomorrow. She came back today and knocked on his door, was told to go in, and for some reason she hadn't been searched on the way in and detonated and what seems like an explosive vest she was wearing.
What might the impact of these attacks be on the political process? If the military surge is said to have worked, how might this impact what everyone is waiting for, the political surge?
Yeah, this is the interesting point. What the U.S. military and the Iraqi government don't want to happen is for the resolve of these Awakening Councils to weaken And of course, those who are committing these attacks, that is precisely their goal. The political gains that everybody is waiting for obviously can only happen in a stable, secure environment. So for Al-Qaeda and other insurgents, instability would suit their ends perfectly.
Paul Tait, senior correspondent for Reuters in Baghdad. Paul, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Officials from the U.S. Department of Agriculture told Congress last week that they're not sure how many schools received meat that was part of the largest beef recall in U.S. history. A third of the recalled beef went to school lunch programs, and 10% of it still hasn't been tracked down. Now, officials say there is no health hazard, but you may remember the video that prompted the recall. It showed cows from the Hallmark Westland Meatpacking Company, too sick to stand, being prodded or forklifted upright so they could pass inspection before slaughter. Well, we're now learning that some schools served that meat before they knew it was the beef in question. That's what happened to our next guest, Robin Vogler. She's food service director for Summers Middle School in Summers, Montana. Now, in a few minutes, we'll get a doctor's report card on school lunch, but we want to start with Robin. And Robin, the USDA says it is extremely unlikely that this recalled beef poses a health risk, but we read that a cook in another Montana school served all of the beef the day before she was warned about it. What happened to you?
I served about half of the product that I had in-house, which would have amounted to about 370 hamburger patties, before I received the news of the recall.
And how does one feel when one gets the recall after you've served the food?
Well, I thought it was shocking and disgusting, and I don't know how you can blanketly say that no health effects are going to be felt by this. I think that that's a fairly bold assumption, you know, especially in light of some of the nature of the disease. The worst-case scenario, of course, would be mad cow disease. That is a possibility, you know, and I just think that it was too soon to say, oh, it's a remote possibility.
Well, and how do you feel about the warning system? Because we know officials with the School Nutrition Association are, you know, urging the Department of Agriculture, USDA, to update the recall communication system for school cafeterias. Do you feel you were properly warned?
Well, it would have been a nicer way to get that news before I had served the product. Apparently, the Humane Society had videotaped some of the blatant abuses earlier.
Well, the Humane Society leaked the video that prompted the alert, but the alert was first sent out on February 5th when the meat was put on hold, a warning not to use it. But then we understand another round came out when it was formally recalled. Do you think that that should be changed?
I do think it should be changed. I think if there's any concern, I'm dealing with a high-risk group, not to mention my personal reputation is for, you know, feeding children a substandard quality of food, and then, you know, just the ramifications in that if someone did get sick, you know, the parents lose faith in the program, all the things considered, and then, yeah, I'm shocked and appalled by the whole works, and I wish that I had been notified earlier.
Well, we're reading that some large school districts in California, you know, have truckloads of this meat, and they're having problems finding landfills to take it, having to pour bleach on it, costing them thousands of dollars, which the USDA says it will reimburse. But what about you? How did you get rid of the meat?
Well, we didn't have nearly that quantity, and so I did just tear apart the packaging, and I just spread it throughout our dumpsters.
Well, many schools stopped serving beef while they investigated the story, but we understand you're going beyond this.
Yes.
What are you going to do now when it comes to meat?
Well, what I have done is cancel all my beef orders with the commodity program that serves us. We have an allotment of money that's given to us on an annual basis, and we can use those funds to buy different commodity products, and a lot of cheese, some vegetables, flour, grains, those sorts of things. And I am not ordering beef from commodity in the future.
From government, you mean?
From government commodity, right.
Yeah.
Right. So I will be looking for local sources, and fortunately for us, we're in Montana, which is an agricultural state, and we do have a number of beef growers in our vicinity, and I have already started talking to them. It is a little bit more cost prohibitive. Obviously, we rely to some extent on the commodity dollars because it helps us feed kids that are low income. We have a substantial number of kids that are on our free and reduced lunch program. And so that helps us. We only make $1.75 per plate on the price of our lunches, so we keep it nice and low because we do have a low-income school that we're serving. And so it's a bit of a hardship to not be able to order this beef, but I do think that we're going to find ways to supplement our diet with it, maybe not eat it as frequently, but certainly concentrate on the quality rather than just, you know, taking a handout.
But $1.75 to spend on each plate of food,
right?
That doesn't seem like a lot. So
it's very low.
Yeah. So, and especially if you replace the government commodity meat with private meat.
Right.
So what are you doing about the menu?
Well, my menu has been printed for the month of March, and I typically offer vegetarian offerings every day of the week. And, you know, we use some beef, but we also distribute it over, you know, the course of a week. I might serve beef once or twice, and I use a lot of grains and legumes and beans, that sort of thing, so we can replace some of the protein with those things.
Well, we understand you take over your job from someone who held your school's food service job since 1947.
That's correct.
Now,
yes.
Did the lunch menu need overhauling?
It did need overhauling. And so that was part of the reason for hiring me, because I had a large background in restaurant food, and I'm also a private chef in the summertime. My thought process was more toward fresh rather than the brown and serve, the frozen product that was coming through the door, which was the predominant makeup of the past menu for the past manager. So I've really done a lot of work to try to turn my program around to offer as much of the fresh foods as possible, and we do baking every day, or at least 4 days a week, with fresh whole wheat flours that we get.
Wow, is this something? I mean, were you given this mandate? What are parents saying?
Well, it is basically a mandate. In light of the diabetes epidemic in our society, up to 40% of the society, is the latest quote that I heard, of kids are obese, not just overweight, obese. So, strangely enough, the USDA has been one of the promoters of changing up children's diets, and they're providing a lot of recipes and ideas for ways that you can integrate whole grains and fresh fruits and vegetables and legumes and beans into the diet. So we are getting away from fats. We are getting away from trans fats specifically. In fact, I anticipate probably the USDA's My Pyramid will even recommend no trans fats next year. But up to this point, you know, things like shortening are still on the commodity list.
Well, one last question. Do you think that, you know, by bringing in things that aren't, you know, corn syrup and are fresher and are better for the kids, at least in the short term, because of the way the food industry is structured right now, that's going to start costing more? Do you think parents are going to pay more?
That remains to be seen. You know, to be able to provide the best quality food, we may be looking at an increase next year, but, you know, we are working on a shoestring. And so I will provide the best quality food that I can within our means.
Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Robin Vogler, Food Service Director for Summers Middle School in Montana. Well, just ahead, we'll get a national school lunch report card. And later, why Elizabeth Bishop is considered one of the great American poets. Back in 1 minute, here and now. The sounds of lunch being served, this at a school in Brookline, Massachusetts. The National School Lunch Program serves more than 30 million children every school day using surplus meat, milk, and eggs provided by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Some of the beef that schools receive was recalled by the USDA last month, and some schools served it before they knew of the recall, as we just heard. Well, our next guest calls the USDA commodity system one of the most significant roadblocks to change in school lunches. Susan Levin is a registered dietitian. She produces the school lunch report card for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. Susan, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And you just heard Robin Vogler, the school food service director from Montana.
I did, and I have to say, I just, you know, hats off to her. She's amazing. She's the kind of food service director that we are just so excited to talk to and hear from. So I just want to commend her on all that she's done.
But for your annual report card, you analyzed lunches in 22 of the nation's largest elementary school districts. Where would she fall? I mean, she's probably not the norm.
No, she's not the norm, but she's becoming more the norm, fortunately, because she is trying. Now, what she's done, which is in reaction to this giant beef recall, is great. Like, she's just saying no more of the commodity beef. You know, I don't know how she's going to do it as far as finances go, but I think that's so great and so important because she's putting the kids first.
Well, let's go to your conclusion that the commodity system that Robin is, you know, rejecting in some part is one of the most significant roadblocks to change. What do you mean by that?
Well, the USDA is just, you know, there's so many conflicts of interest involved with the USDA, and they buy up all these surplus foods every year and dump them into schools. It has nothing to do with nutrition. It has everything to do with economics.
That's critics of corn syrup would say the same thing, that corn syrup gets poured into school lunches and it subsidizes the corn industry, but it's the worst thing for kids. But on the other hand, when it's government subsidies, the USDA commodity system, low-income children in many towns rely on it. Isn't it better that they have something? And, you know, along with that, a lot of people who are adults now grew up with really bad school lunches, and they seem to be doing fine. So what's happening now?
Well, I don't think that it's a good excuse to say, you know, I grew up on really bad diet. Too bad for me. At least I figured it out later in life. But in a way, that's not really fair. Not everybody has the opportunity or the luxury to sit around and rehaul and analyze their diet when they get into their 20s. Most people don't do that. And to me, I want to get, as a dietitian, I want to start young.
Well, let's take a look at your report card. You analyzed 22 of the country's largest elementary school districts. First of all, how did you do your analysis? What were you looking for in the report card?
Well, we look for a few different things. We're trying to see that they not only meet the USDA nutrition requirements, but they go above and beyond that. That's what gets them really up there. But we want to see that they do serve plant-based or vegetarian foods every day, that they do have fresh fruits and vegetables, that their fruits and vegetables aren't drowning in cheese sauce, for example. Mm-hmm. And we also like to see that they're providing some kind of nutrition education or incentive program. So it's one thing to have a very healthy meal option in the cafeteria line. It's another thing to have it right next to the chicken nuggets. We want there to be incentives for those kids to pick the healthier food item.
It's a point system. The Pinellas County schools in Florida got the only A, but right below them, Charlotte and Mecklenburg schools in North Carolina with an A-. Why? What did they do that you liked?
They did well because they had interesting vegetarian foods like beans and rice. So they were kind of like red beans and rice, keeping it kind of southern so the kids felt like it wasn't some wacky food. It's sort of a culturally appropriate food, and it changes every day.
On the other hand, the schools that failed completely, Omaha Public Schools, Nebraska, Anchorage School District in Alaska, Hancock County Schools in West Virginia, Jordan County School District, Utah. And you say that the schools that failed should offer healthy vegetarian dishes such as polenta with spicy tofu. Now, is part of the problem maybe not just that the schools don't have the resources or the wherewithal to even bring in the people who could cook that, but are kids going to eat that?
I think that's where incentive programs come in. Some schools are fortunate enough to have things like a garden where they actually grew okra. Then they went into the kitchen. They had a chef show how you could prepare okra 5 different ways. And then the next day they served it on the menu, and the kids gobbled it up. But even better is those kids went home and said, "Hey, Mom, let's buy okra."
Well, we're talking about the school lunch report card from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Susan Levin, there was good news with your report card this year. We understand that since you began doing this in 2001, there's an increase in the availability of vegetarian and vegan entrees, an increase in the number of schools offering alternatives to dairy milk, like bottled water or soy milk. But I'm just wondering, we began by talking about the meat recall and how that affected school lunchrooms. And we're reading that federal auditors' reports show that there are many more problems in school lunchrooms than that. The USDA's lunch program has been cited for poor safeguards against bacterial contamination, choosing lunch program vendors with known food safety violations. Is there something else that has to happen for school lunch in general, some sort of oversight?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I spent time at a hearing that was in reaction to the beef recall. It was the USDA presenting their case in defense of themselves, while this committee, which is chaired by Representative DeLauro from Connecticut, she just basically laid into the USDA and said, "You guys have got to shape up," and getting really agitated and angry. And I felt a little bit of relief about that. I was like, okay, people know that there's a problem. So I felt really good about the fact that maybe, sadly, in reaction to this recall, but maybe some things will change with the type of media attention that they're getting from this.
Susan Levin, registered dietitian with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which each year produces the School Lunch Report Card. Susan, thanks so much.
No, thank you.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the new documentary about the trial of the anti-war activist, the Chicago 10. Was Bobby Seale really duct-taped to his chair? That's tomorrow. Still ahead, we move on to Mississippi in primaries. After the news, Here and Now. Mississippi's Clarion Ledger reports today that tomorrow's Democratic primary is the first since Jimmy Carter's run in 1976 with this much excitement. Nationally, though, Democratic Party leaders are increasingly concerned that the deadlocked race between Senators Obama and Clinton might drain party coffers for important Senate races. And the debate about what to do with Florida and Michigan ratcheted up this past weekend, with some party leaders proposing mail-in do-over primaries, others objecting to such political mulligans. And Saturday Night Live continues to have a field day in a skit mocking the now famous Clinton 3 a.m. phone call ad. A President Obama calls still Senator Clinton, complete with cold cream and sleeping cap, for advice.
"Don't you see that I'm in a panic, a blind, unreasoning, inexperienced panic?
For God's sake, Mr. President, man up. Calm down and listen. First of all, go to our key allies, the British, the Germans, the French."
"Hold on, I'm trying to write this down. Germans, French."
So, can voters in Mississippi hope to be heard above this fray, or affect the stalemate between Obama, who has more delegates, and Clinton, who has bigger states? Sid Salter is the perspective editor for the Clarion Ledger there in Jackson, Mississippi. Sid, put the excitement in the state in perspective for us.
The last time that Mississippi really got on the radar screen in a Democratic primary was 1988, and the last time that it gave a victory to an eventual president was, as you say, in 1976 when Jimmy Carter ran. And even then, with Carter as a Southern Baptist, sort of in the gold buckle of the Bible Belt here, he was only able to win a victory of about 2%. So this is an unprecedented amount of resources and time from major candidates, and I think Mississippians are enjoying their 15 minutes of fame. But it's still a long march from the primaries to November in terms of Democrats carrying the state.
Well, that's because this is a state that's gone Republican for so long. How are Republicans responding to the Democratic excitement?
I think that the whole of the state is genuinely interested in hearing what the Clinton campaign and Senator Obama have to say. I think the Republicans are still confident, but make no mistake, here as in nationally, the Republican establishment very much wants to run against Senator Clinton, not Senator Obama, and the reason for that is selfish. There is a special Senate election to choose a successor to retired Senator Trent Lott, that seat now held by interim Senator Roger Wicker. And many Republicans here in Mississippi believe that if Senator Obama is the Democratic nominee, that it will pull a November turnout of historic proportions and propel a Democratic Senate nominee, former Governor Ronnie Musgrove, to a position to score a takeaway. So the Senate race does have some national implications, and therefore Republican and Democratic interest in this primary is at an all-time high.
Well, a couple things off what you've just said. First of all, the national media, even the international media, is saying that this is a great state for Barack Obama, as you just alluded to, because of so many black voters. Do people there see themselves as that kind of a monolith?
Well, I think it's greatly overstated, but the fact of the matter is Mississippi is not in a vacuum. You have the same dynamics working here. Young voters, African-American voters, heavily motivated towards Senator Obama. The more traditional Democratic establishment still hanging tough with the Clintons. Senator Clinton, President Clinton, and Chelsea Clinton have actively campaigned in Mississippi over the weekend. I covered a speech by President Clinton in Meridian on Saturday night, and that crowd was about 85% white, mostly members of organized labor. And so the Clintons are contesting every vote, and they're particularly targeting rural, more traditional white Democratic voters, and judging by the size of the crowds, doing so with some success.
So Senator Obama is making his first appearance in Mississippi. You know, it was said that ads from the Clinton campaign and skits on Saturday Night Live hurt Obama in last week's primaries. The press has written tougher articles, one in the New York Times this weekend, painting him as lost in the halls of Congress. Another skit from Saturday Night Live, painting him as someone who may not know his way around a White House. Is any of this national sort of noise resonating in Mississippi?
Not as much. I think you see African-American Democrats are absolutely on fire at this point to have an opportunity to cast a vote for a credible, competitive African-American candidate. And I don't think the Saturday Night Live has a tremendous amount of political impact in Mississippi. I think Senator Obama's media buy in Mississippi has far outstretched the Clinton campaigns. Senator Obama has been the first presidential candidate to get up on TV and stay there for a while, and I think the Obama campaign knows that they need to carry Mississippi as they did Georgia, Alabama, and Louisiana. So, no, I don't see Saturday Night Live skits or that whole dynamic having much traction here.
Well, what does your colleague Gary Pettis in the paper compares this year to 1976 on issues such as gas prices and recession fears? What are some of the other issues that are fueling people's votes?
Mississippi, much like the rest of the country, is struggling with energy prices, but Mississippi perhaps has been struggling a little longer. Our gas went to $3 a gallon the day after Hurricane Katrina. Mississippi also, on a per capita basis, has a pretty significant investment of service personnel, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have some guard units that are serving third tours of duty in Iraq, and so war fatigue is high here. Economic concerns, particularly over gas prices, because gas prices hit poor people harder than they do more middle class or affluent folks. And Mississippi is still the poorest state in the union. So gas prices here are a daily source of not just consternation, but true economic struggle. So I think the economy and the war in Iraq are the two prime moving issues.
And are those issues, as from what you can tell with polling and just you know your feet on the ground, are those issues going to drive voters in Mississippi to one or another of the Democratic candidates, or to a Democrat over a Republican, or a Republican over the Democrat?
I think that the Democratic Party has a better legitimate shot of carrying Mississippi in November than at any time since Jimmy Carter was a candidate in 76. And neither of these candidates will enjoy the benefit of the Southern Baptist push, but there is significant frustration among the voters here, and I think for the first time in 32 years, the Democrats have a shot at taking Mississippi.
Do you see Clinton or Obama appealing to them more on any of these issues, or is that going to boil down to the same thing it's seemed to have boiled down to in other states, just a feeling about which candidate can do better on those issues?
I think that in Mississippi, it's the ability of Senator Obama to draw infrequent voters to the polls for one shot. I think that's a dynamic not to be underestimated.
Sid Salter is perspective editor for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. Sid, thanks for your perspective on tomorrow's primary.
Thank you, Robin.
And a quick reminder, if you're going to be away from your radio tomorrow, you can always listen to our show stream live at our website, here-now.org, or download a podcast, take us with you, here-now.org. Before we go today, rediscovering the late poet Elizabeth Bishop. You're listening to Here and Now. Most people play the lottery to win something they don't have or want more of, money, maybe a new car. But in Oregon, a one-of-a-kind lottery is underway, and the prize is health insurance. More than 91,000 Oregonians have entered a lottery for a chance to be enrolled in the state's standard health care benefit plan. A computer has been randomly selecting the names of applicants who will get notices in the mail starting this week that they've won. Joining us is Jim Edge. He's the Medicaid director for the Oregon Department of Human Services. They're conducting this lottery. So, Jim, first of all, how many of the 91,000 people who've entered will wind up winners?
We think there will be room for about 10,000 additional people to be added to this program. It currently has about 17,000 people in it. We can operate it at an average of about 24,000 people. So we're going to be adding people on a monthly basis until we average out to 24,000 for the biennium that we're funded for.
Who's eligible for the healthcare lottery in Oregon?
The healthcare program that we're opening right now is for anyone below 100% of the federal poverty level, and that's about $21,000 for a family of four.
Well, you know, someone asked, first of all, if the state can afford to add more people to the rolls of this health plan, why not just find the people who have the most need instead of making it be the luck of the draw?
Well, because we are a Medicaid program, we don't base eligibility for the program on disease category. If you have cancer, that you're at a higher priority than if you have heart disease or something like that.
Don't you have a situation where we read in the Oregon papers about a 61-year-old woman who can't afford her insulin, so she hasn't been taking her insulin regularly, and yet on the other hand, she might get beaten out by a low-income, very low-income, college student who, I mean, you want to have your college kids insured, but they're not going to have as many health problems as a 61-year-old. But that college student might still win.
Well, there's a combination of things there. One is that we simply cannot, by federal regulation, open up the Medicaid program by disease category and try to calculate the severity of medical disease condition and open it up only to those individuals. The bigger issue is that we have in Oregon about 600,000 people who are uninsured, who are without health insurance. And of these low-income people, we have about 130,000 that are without health insurance. They're all desperate to get health insurance, and we're doing the best we can to cover as many of them as we can.
Well, tell us how you got to this place, because this is the standard plan from Oregon. It was once heralded as a highlight of the state's overall health care plan. It covered more than 132,000 low-income residents at its peak in 1995. And then the budget was cut, and the program was closed to newcomers in 2004, we understand.
Right. The budget was cut to the extent that we couldn't afford to keep as many people in it as were in this program. It's not part of the traditional Medicaid program. We calculated the number of people that we could keep in the program. We were considerably over that number at that time, so we closed the program to new enrollment. We didn't want to kick anyone off of the program, but we used the process of attrition over time to drop below 24,000. And when we finally got far enough below it, which is the point we're at now, now we're going to begin adding people back to the program and trying to maintain an average of 24,000 people.
Right. You know, what a great thing for the 10,000 or so people, I think you said, that are going to find out that they won. Oh, and you're going to have 80,000 who didn't win.
Well, sure. But it does point out the fact that we need to do something about the high uninsurance rate in this country, the number of people without health insurance. Everyone without health insurance, sooner or later, ends up needing health care. And right now, what people tend to do is to put off getting health care if they don't have health insurance, to go to the emergency room as a last resort, to get sicker, to die younger. We need to do something about the uninsured in this nation as a whole, and in Oregon, and is in particular in our case.
Tim Edge, Medicaid Director for the Oregon Department of Human Services. They're conducting the state's one-of-a-kind health care lottery. Jim, thanks for telling us about it.
Okay, you're welcome.
Well, we're going to end this week with guitarist Pat Metheny, but we start the Week in the Arts in 1 minute with the poetry of the late Elizabeth Bishop, Here and Now.
The art of losing isn't hard to master.
That's Cameron Diaz in the 2005 film In Her Shoes, reading the poem One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. Diaz's character, who has a reading disability, learns to appreciate poetry through Bishop's meditation on loss of love. Well, Elizabeth Bishop died over 28 years ago, but her poetry continues to inspire. In 2006, actress Amy Irving brought a one-woman show based on Bishop's life to Broadway. And on Valentine's Day of this year, Elizabeth Bishop Poems, Prose, and Letters was released, and this compilation of all her works is already in its second printing. Lloyd Schwartz co-edited the book. He's also a professor of English at UMass Boston and, of course, classical music critic for Fresh Air. Lloyd, nice to see you again on Here and Now.
Great to be here, Rob.
Tell us, I mean, we hear a little of what her appeal might have been, her heart out there in her work. What else is her appeal?
Well, I think originally she was admired for her great eye and her kind of painterly sense of detail. And I think the more she wrote, the more she published, and the more deeply people read of her, they really found some extraordinary human emotion and a sense of the complexity of life, how complicated it is to just live in the world.
Do you remember the first poems of hers you ever read?
I do, and it wasn't a poem that I read. It was a poem that I listened to. I had a great teacher when I was an undergraduate at Queens College in New York, and I remember her reading to us a poem that I'd never heard of by a person I'd never heard of named Elizabeth Bishop.
Do you remember the poem?
The poem was called The Man Moth, and it just completely knocked me out. It moved me and excited me, and I thought, I have to read more poems by this poet.
Well, you have to read some of this poem for us.
I would love to.
Thank you.
Let me read the last stanza and tell you a little bit about what comes before that. She writes that she saw a newspaper misprint for the word mammoth that came out to be man-moth, and she had this idea of this fantasy creature who is very much like a poet who comes out of the center of the earth and rides the subway backwards and crawls up the wall of buildings. And this is the way the poem ends. If you catch him, hold up a flashlight to his eye. It's all dark pupil, an entire night itself, whose haired horizon tightens as he stares back and closes up the eye. Then from the lids, one tear, his only possession, like the bee's sting, slips. Slyly, he palms it, and if you're not paying attention, he'll swallow it. However, if you watch, he'll hand it over, cool as from underground springs and pure enough to drink.
How lovely. So obviously that was one of her 90 published works.
Yes, it was in her first book.
But we want to touch briefly on the big brouhaha in 2006 in the poetry world when her 120 unpublished pieces, some would say unfinished works, were first published. It was Edgar Allan Poe and the Jukebox, edited by The New Yorker's Alice Quinn, but Helen Vendler, in a review for The New Republic, savaged it. You know, people said Elizabeth Bishop would be spinning in her grave. You've chosen, this is all of her works for the first time in one place, including
yes.
the previously unpublished. Why did you include those that some people feel she would never have wanted to see in print?
They expand our sense of who she was as a poet. And maybe there was a word or a syllable or a line that she didn't feel she had exactly right. But we look at them now And some of these are among her very best poems, and they're beautiful.
Give me a couple of lines or stanza that illustrate that.
Well, this is a short love poem that she wrote in Brazil. Close, close all night the lovers keep. They turn together in their sleep. Close as two pages in a book that read each other in the dark. Each knows all the other knows, learned by heart. From head to toes.
I love that. Again, that's Elizabeth Bishop's work. I know that there's one of her published works that is one of your favorites. It's called In the Waiting Room.
The story is that she has gone with her aunt to the dentist, and her aunt is in the dentist's office, and young Elizabeth, just a few days before her 7th birthday, is sitting in the waiting room reading the National Geographic. And she has an identity crisis. She starts to wonder who she is and why she is a human being and why she is like other human beings and how alike the people in the waiting room are to the sort of bizarre tribal women who are pictured in the National Geographic. Hmm. I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher. At shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots, and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps, I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen.
In the waiting room of the dentist, imagine that.
And she wrote this when she was turning 60 and still questioning her place in the world and what it means to be
right.
Human.
Lloyd Schwartz, we have to point out you also have the letters that she sent to people. I love, here's a little postscript, if I may, just a couple lines from her letter
sure.
to Ann Stevenson. She says, I went to see O Processo, the trial, which is absolutely dreadful. Have you seen it? I haven't read the book for ages, but in spite of the morbidity of Kafka, etc., I like to remember that when he read his stories out loud to his friends, he used to have to stop because he got to laughing so. Tell me more, just your thought about the letters. What do they tell us?
You know, her poems are incredibly polished and finished. And the letters, you can hear her speaking voice. A lot of her thoughts about poetry and art and the world and other people, she was a great gossip, are all there in the letters.
Lloyd Schwartz, speaking of the letters and poetry and prose of Elizabeth Bishop, I know you have one last thing you'd like to read for us. What shall this be?
I'd like to read a short poem that she finished the year before she died, and she died very suddenly.
In 1979,
and the poem didn't get published until shortly after she died, so it's her first posthumous poem. Caught, the bubble in the spirit level, a creature divided. And the compass needle wobbling and wavering, undecided. Freed, the broken thermometer's mercury running away. And the rainbow bird from the narrow bevel of the empty mirror, flying wherever it feels like, gay.
Lloyd Schwartz reading Elizabeth Bishop's first posthumously published poem. How perfect. Lloyd is co-editor, along with Robert Giroux, of Elizabeth Bishop, Poems, Prose, and Letters. Lloyd, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.